This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to Community News covering Milford and its surrounding towns. Thanks to the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind for their ongoing support. This is Sarah Susskind. In the next hour, we will be bringing you news from the Milford Daily News covering the week of June 2nd through June 9th, 2026. If you are listening on June 10th at 8 a.m., Poets Corner is coming up next at 9 o'clock. Our first article, Peregrine Falcon Population Returning. They were once all but extinct in Massachusetts, but peregrine falcons have made a comeback in the Bay State. And Massachusetts officials are trying to make sure these falcons are protected. Massachusetts is now home to more than 40 territorial pairs of peregrine falcons, which are known to be the fastest birds on Earth. On May 27th, at the Gillis Bridge in Newburyport, the Massachusetts Department of Transportation and Massachusetts Wildlife banded four recently hatched peregrine falcon chicks. The Mass DOT and Mass Wildlife officials also installed artificial nesting boxes across the state to provide a safe location for falcons to nest and raise their young. Nesting boxes installed throughout Massachusetts. Mass DOT and Mass Wildlife maintain peregrine falcon nesting boxes at 16 bridges across the state. Through this partnership, Mass Wildlife and Mass DOT support the conservation of peregrine falcons on bridges, which in turn controls pigeon populations and prevents waste buildup from rusting bridge components, MassDOT said in a press release. The Gillis Bridge nesting box was installed in 2018 and has since hatched and fledged 29 chicks. A camera that takes a photo every 15 minutes during the daytime lets the public view their growth. What to know about peregrine falcons? These falcons are actually the fastest birds on Earth, with dive speeds over 240 miles per hour, according to the Mass DOT. Which noted that 2026 marks the 40th year of peregrine falcon restoration efforts in the Bay State. Though the falcons have made a comeback in population, peregrine falcons are currently listed as special concern under the Massachusetts Endangered Species Act, according to Mass DOT. Why did these falcons disappear from the Bay State? Pesticides used in the first half of the 1900s drove the disappearance of the peregrine falcons. By 1995, due to the widespread use of harmful pesticides like DDT, there were no nesting peregrine pairs left in Massachusetts, the Mass DOT stated. In 1984 and 1985, Mass Wildlife and Partners released young falcons in downtown Boston, successfully leading to the first modern Massachusetts nest in 1987 on the Customs House Tower in Boston. Where are the nesting boxes located? These are some of the locations according to mass.gov. Custom House Tower, located in downtown Boston, this is the oldest and most successful nest site in the state. Harvard University, a nest box is located on the east side of the Memorial Hall Tower in Cambridge. UMass Lowell, a nest box is situated on the roof of Fox Hall in the North Campus. Ayer Mill Clock Tower, a famous nesting spot in Lawrence. Other buildings, sited on buildings in Chelsea, Watertown, and Lowell. UMass Amherst, nest box on the roof of the W.E.B. Du Bois Library. Mercantile Center, located at 120 Front Street in downtown Worcester. Quarries. Falcons occupy quarry cliff faces in Holyoke, Peabody, Saugus, Swampscott, and West Roxbury. Greater Boston. Chelsea Street Bridge in Chelsea and the Tobin Bridge, Charleston, Chelsea. Central and Western Mass. French King Bridge, Irving Gill, Calvin Coolidge Bridge, Northampton, I-91 Bridge over the Deerfield River, Deerfield, and the I-391 Muller Bridge, Holyoke. Southeastern Mass, Brightman Street Bridge in Fall River. Our next article, City Urged to Not Renew License Plate Reader System. The City Police Department has until June 30th to decide whether it will renew its contract with Flock Safety, a license plate reader system that many argue works like a type of Big Brother by monitoring people and possibly being used by federal immigration officials. A group of residents calling themselves Framingham Fights Back have started a grassroots effort to convince police officials against renewing the contract. I don't think a lot of people out there in Framingham or other communities realize how much surveillance is really going on out there, said Kate Merritt O'Toole, head of Framingham Fights Back. The police department purchased the cameras in good faith to help with crime and safety. All good reasons. However, Flock is not acting in good faith. Flock opponents say the company collects data from throughout the country and that it's unclear what happens with it or with whom it's shared. While the company says it does not share data with Federal Immigration and Customs Enforcement, residents say there's no way to prove it. They're, Flock, on their way to building a mass surveillance tool, Merritt O'Toole said. That's not a conspiracy theory. It's real life. I'll be the first one to say it. When I first started learning about this, I was like, come on, this sounds like a conspiracy theory. This is far-fetched. But it's really not. Natick, Cambridge, and Watertown drop Flock. Several communities throughout the country have dropped Flock, including in Massachusetts. In Natick, the police department joined Flock as part of a pilot program in December. But a month later, the select board ordered the department to leave the program and remove the cameras, citing privacy concerns. Also in December, Cambridge cut ties with Flock after company technicians installed two cameras without the city's knowledge, according to WCVB-TV. Watertown also ended a contract with Flock in January before cameras were even installed. According to the Watertown News, city manager George Proakis said he was concerned about how the data collected could be used by Flock or other agencies. Other local police departments are using the Flock system, including Milford and Marlborough. In March, Medway added several Flock cameras to the two that it has had for several years. We've had them for many years, and they've been managed by us, no one else, Medway Police Chief William Kingsbury told the Daily News in April. The information we get is purged every 30 days. Flock doesn't sell it. They don't have access to it. Framingham says it has not committed to renewing the contract. A representative for Flock could not be reached for comment. Previously, Flock explained that while it owns the devices, its customers are not allowed to remove or relocate them, its clients own the data captured by sensors and can choose whether to share that data and with whom. For its part, Framingham police have not signed to renew the contract yet, police spokeswoman Lieutenant Rachel Mickens said. She said police are working with the mayor's office and a city council subcommittee regarding use of the cameras and addressing community concerns. Currently, the city solicitor's office is currently reviewing and updating contract language. Based on community feedback, the department has limited information sharing through Flock to only Massachusetts law enforcement agencies. Out-of-state sharing is limited only to criminal cases and is approved on a case-by-case basis. Police also share information on the city's public transparency portal, allowing residents to review information about the program and use. The Framingham Police Department remains committed to balancing public safety needs with transparency, accountability, and the privacy concerns of the community it serves, Mickens said. Mayor Charlie Sisitsky declined to comment. The city's public information officer, Susan Petroni, said the mayor is waiting to see what the city's legal department has to say after reviewing the issue before issuing a statement. ACLU says Framingham uses Flock for vague reasons. The ACLU of Massachusetts has concerns with Framingham's use of Flock. Gideon Epstein, policy counsel for ACLU of Massachusetts, said the organization has done public records requests of Flock's camera data. The ACLU said that when Framingham officers attempt to access Flock data, they are sometimes providing inadequate reasons for doing so. Just looking at the data, the one thing that is immediately concerning is many of the searches the Framingham police officers do include completely vague and nondescriptive search reasons, Epstein said. They'll use the word invest, presumably for investigation or well-being. Some of the searches include just search in the search reason. What's so concerning about the vague descriptions is that it leaves the door open for abuse and misuse. Epstein cited cases from throughout the country, including one in Milwaukee, where an officer used the Flock system more than 100 times to track a romantic partner, as well as one in Texas, where an officer tried to track a woman who left the state to possibly terminate a pregnancy. Here at the ACLU, we actually don't think license plate reading technology inherently creates a problem, Epstein said. We think it can be a good law enforcement tool, but with proper guardrails. I think at the core of the problem, Flock is a license plate reader that encourages departments it contracts with to share data. Merritt O'Toole noted that data is stored for 30 days. Too long, she thinks. She's also concerned that there's no way to know why another department is using Framingham data. She said, even if ICE doesn't have access to Framingham data, who's to say that a department with a good relationship with ICE won't use its access to get information for the federal agency? I don't say this lightly, but I don't think police departments really appreciate the downstream effect this could have, Merritt O'Toole said. There's definitely a trickle-down effect when the data leaves Framingham. We have no idea, and that's the scary part. Framingham Fights Back is asking people to write letters to the department and to the mayor's office expressing their desire for the city to leave the Flock program. Ideally, our end game is to get it shut down, Merritt O'Toole said. We don't want to take a tool out of the Framingham Police Department's hands to hurt their ability to solve crimes. But is it worth the risk of our personal information not being secured? Our next article, Clover Comeback Begins at Key Boston Area Locations. Clover, the Boston area vegetarian fast food chain that announced its closure last week, is coming back. The restaurant, founded by MIT graduate Air Muir in 2008, said it had been struggling financially especially following the COVID-19 pandemic. Clover's 11 Massachusetts locations and catering business shuttered on May 28th. Less than a week later, on June 3rd, a Clover spokesperson said that an investor had stepped in and that the company would reopen its doors this month. "We finalized a deal with a mission-aligned investor who was motivated by the strength of the brand and the differentiation of our locally sourced menu," the spokesperson said in an email to the USA Today network. CEO Julia Rin Piper said that the outpouring of support from customers helped pave the way for Clover's return. "Last Tuesday, when we announced we were closing after 17 years, we were not prepared for the response. We knew people would miss us, but we didn't understand how much they would miss us," Piper said in a statement on Clover's website. At a certain point, the amount of public outcry became so widespread that it led to an email, then a phone call, then several phone calls, then some very late-night meetings. The chain built a following for its plant-based, kosher-certified menu items, including sandwiches, rice bowls, salads, soups, cookies, and teas. Clover did not provide details about its new investor, but added that it would be making some changes to address its financial challenges. "Inflationary pressures on our industry remain an issue, of course, and we are now working hard on implementing operational changes to ensure the financial sustainability of Clover," the spokesperson said. When is Clover set to reopen? Clover is set to reopen its core Cambridge and Somerville locations at lunchtime on Tuesday, June 9th, according to Piper. The chain will begin serving breakfast again on Wednesday, June 10th. It was not immediately clear whether Clover will reopen its other locations outside of Cambridge and Somerville. The company said it will continue updating customers as it works to reopen. "If you love Clover, when we reopen, could you commit to introducing one new person to us? Every one of you reading this is an ambassador for our mission," Piper said. "Tell a coworker, trick a skeptical carnivore, bring your crush." Our next article: Framingham District Court has acting clerk magistrate. Framingham District Court has a new acting clerk magistrate. Chief Justice of the District Court Stacey Fortas has appointed Worcester District Court Assistant Clerk Magistrate Michael Prosser as Acting Clerk Magistrate in Framingham District Court. Prosser steps in for Clerk Magistrate Robert Jubinville, who has taken a leave of absence after announcing his intention to run for Norfolk County District Attorney. Prosser has been with the Massachusetts trial courts for almost 37 years. Most recently, he has been assistant clerk magistrate in Worcester District Court. Clerk magistrates hold hearings for criminal complaints, which are often minor crimes that do not involve arrests. The clerk can dismiss the case, move the case before a judge, or issue a fine. In addition, when someone is arrested, a clerk magistrate must find probable cause for charges before the case is arraigned. On occasion, a clerk magistrate can oversee arraignments if a judge is not available and can sign search warrants. Our next article: El Niño could have an effect on Massachusetts. A developing El Niño in the Pacific Ocean could influence the weather here in Massachusetts and the rest of New England. More specifically, it could affect hurricane season, which runs from June 1st to November 30th each year. Experts have warned for months about the potential for a strong or even super El Niño, as climate models continued to show a pattern that could rival some of the most intense events on record. The latest observations include warmer-than-normal sea surface temperatures and bursts of westerly winds that help push stored heat from the western Pacific toward the Central and Eastern Pacific. The 2026 North American summer season is entering a critical transition phase, Severe Weather Europe wrote. Latest data confirm that a strong El Niño event is not only developing, but is already showing early signs of its presence in the global atmospheric circulation. We are now witnessing the first detectable changes in pressure and temperature patterns across the United States and Canada. If current trends continue, forecasters say the emerging El Niño pattern could influence the jet stream and shift seasonal weather across North America, leading into late summer and fall. What is El Niño? El Niño occurs when the winds blowing east to west in the Pacific Ocean along the equator weaken, allowing warmer waters to collect across the eastern Pacific's equatorial region, the Weather Channel said. When this happens, it can influence weather globally as well as in the U.S. When there is a strong El Niño, the chance of a hurricane hitting New England goes down. Typically, the stronger the El Niño, the more shear that occurs in the Atlantic Ocean, the Weather Channel said, which has a tempering effect. Hurricanes hate shear in the atmosphere, so El Niño occurring during the summer and lasting into the fall can lead to weaker and a lower frequency of hurricanes in the Atlantic Basin, the Weather Channel said. What is a Kelvin wave? At the center of the El Niño development is a Kelvin wave, a large pulse of subsurface warm water now rising toward the ocean surface. Think of it as the summer equivalent of the polar vortex in winter forecasting. A term that sounds dramatic, but describes a natural repeating part of the climate system and is largely just a buzzword. A Kelvin wave is a slow-moving pulse of warm water that travels eastward just below the ocean surface along the equator in the Pacific Ocean, according to NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Unlike surface waves that break at the ocean, these are subsurface shifts in ocean heat that move across thousands of miles. La Niña, which means little girl in Spanish, has the opposite effect of El Niño, according to NOAA. During La Niña events, trade winds are even stronger than usual, pushing more warm water towards Asia, NOAA said. Off the west coast of the Americas, upwelling increases, bringing cold, nutrient-rich water to the surface. These cold waters in the Pacific push the jet stream northward. Because cold waters in the Pacific push the jet stream northward during La Niña, more droughts can occur in the southern U.S. with heavy rains and flooding occurring at the same time in the Pacific Northwest and Canada. Our next article, Mike's Pastry Headed to Boston's Logan Airport. Travelers at Boston's Logan International Airport will soon be able to taste a North End classic before even leaving the terminal. Mike's Pastry, the iconic Italian bakery known for its cannoli, plans to open a food stall inside Terminal C this year, according to the airport's retail developer, Marketplace Development. The outpost will feature the bakery's filled-to-order cannoli, cheesecake slices, lobster tails, and a full espresso bar, giving flyers another way to fuel up before or after a flight. It will also offer travel-ready items for passengers to bring on board a plane and take to family and friends, the developer said. Mike's Pastry has always been about sharing a piece of Boston with everyone who walks through our doors, owner Angelo Papa said in a statement. Bringing that experience to Boston Logan is special for us. Whether you're heading out or just arriving, we're excited to give travelers an easy way to grab a true taste of the North End. Beyond its flagship North End location, Mike's Pastry also operates shops in Cambridge's Harvard Square, Somerville's Assembly Row, and Boston's TD Garden. Near each location, customers can be seen toting the bakery's signature white and blue boxes tied with string. Mike's Pastry Logan Airport stall is slated to be open 7 days a week from 5 a.m. to 10 p.m. When will Mike's Pastry open at Logan Airport? While Mike's Pastry is expected to open at Logan Airport sometime in 2026, an exact date has not yet been announced. Other Mike's Pastry locations in the Boston area. Mike's Pastry, founded in 1946, currently has 4 Boston area locations, including its original North End store. Boston, North End, 300 Hanover Street, Boston, Mass. Boston, TD Garden, 100 Legends Way, Boston, Mass. Cambridge, 11 Dunster Street, Cambridge, Mass. And Somerville, 445 Revolution Drive, Somerville, Mass. Our next article, 5 areas to have significant impact for businesses. Framingham is entering a new phase of economic planning as the Framingham Economic Development Corporation unveiled its first annual development plan, identifying 5 priority development areas with the strongest potential for long-term growth. The plan arrives at a time when Framingham is grappling with budget pressures and searching for new ways to drive economic development. The Development Corporation Chair, Doug Lawrence, told the Daily News the strategy is designed not only to highlight opportunities, but to direct Framingham toward projects capable of creating long-term economic impact. We are looking at sections of the city that have known opportunities and where we think we can have a significant impact on potentially bringing new development to the city, he said. What parts of Framingham are ID'd for redevelopment? As part of the plan, the corporation pinpointed several locations across the city where it believes redevelopment could deliver the most immediate and long-term benefits. The priority development areas include Pearl and Franklin Streets, downtown Framingham concentration of small business, strong potential for mixed-use, transit-oriented development. Waverly Street Corridor, Route 135. Corridor where rezoning could strengthen connections between downtown and surrounding neighborhoods. Speen Street and Old Connecticut Path, targeted for revitalization of aging corporate office parks. Saxonville at Concord Street Historic Village Center, with redevelopment opportunities at the Saxonville Fire Station and Athenaeum. 990 Corporate Center Tech Park, major employment hub central to the city's life sciences and technology companies. The EDC will work with city officials, property owners, and private developers to advance projects within each priority development area. Lawrence said the process will take time, but pointed to cities like Boston and Marlborough as examples of long-term planning paying off. They see the fruits of their efforts from 10 years ago. In fact, they're seeing significant benefit from economic development in their city budget processes. I think we'll be able to do that kind of thing, but it will take some time, he said. Framingham is facing a challenging budget year, and councillors have repeatedly said strategic development is essential to strengthening the city's tax base. Its annual plan was unanimously approved by the City Council on May 19th, who were overwhelmingly positive about the board's plans. Each year, the mayor and council have to approve the plan, and new PDAs can be added as opportunities emerge. Job creation and quality of life improvements. Beyond land use and redevelopment, the EDC's strategy places a strong emphasis on job creation and reducing the need for long commutes, Lawrence said. We're a suburban community, but people commute to other cities and to Boston Center. To the degree that we can establish good-paying jobs here in Framingham, we can start to cut down on commuting and on traffic, he said. We'd love to have those great jobs here in Framingham so that people aren't having to jump on the Mass Pike and join the traffic jam every day. The corporation, created under former Governor Charlie Baker, is a state-chartered public entity with the authority to support redevelopment and pursue projects that reinforce the city's economic infrastructure. Lawrence said the city also wants to expand amenities that make Framingham a more attractive place to live and work. That includes improving the restaurant scene and exploring new recreational opportunities, such as a potential golf course that could draw visitors from outside the city. Plans for Pearl Street Garage. One of the first major efforts is the Pearl Street Garage, which is in the process of being transferred from city ownership to the Framingham Economic Development Corporation. This isn't a sale of the property, but a shifting of control over the property. The underutilized structure has significant infrastructure issues, according to the report. The goal is to redevelop the structure and the surrounding area into a transit-oriented mixed-use area. Plans for the site include possibly integrating the existing garage to include the potential for mixed-use development that will benefit from its close proximity to the commuter rail station, or demolishing and replacing the entire structure. Our downtown has suffered setbacks from the closure of Denison and the General Motors facility. It has become a more dynamic place and retail location. The housing that's been built has allowed the development of the downtown to serve people who live in the downtown. So we want to continue the momentum in downtown, Lawrence said. Positioning Framingham in the innovation economy. The corporation also sees major potential in the Route 990 Innovation Corridor, home to companies like Sanofi Genzyme, one of the city's largest taxpayers. Lawrence emphasized that Framingham is not trying to compete with Cambridge's Harvard and MIT innovation hubs, but instead offer a more affordable alternative for companies and workers. We have to think about how we compete as a city versus other cities in Massachusetts, versus other parts of the world, and what our competitive advantages are. I would say the biggest advantage is that we're part of the Boston area, so we can tap into the innovation community, he said. The vision includes adding amenities, including restaurants and services, to help attract companies to the area. Our next article, Law Seeks to Help LaPorta's Family. Massachusetts lawmakers are considering a bill that would promote deceased Uxbridge police officer Stephen LaPorta in a move to both honor him and support his family. LaPorta died January 7th in a crash that occurred while he was assisting a motorist on an icy stretch of Route 146. He left behind his wife, Shannon LaPorta, and his young son, Matthew. The bill, filed by Senator Ryan Fatman, Republican Webster, would posthumously promote LaPorta to the rank of sergeant so that his surviving spouse would receive a higher retirement benefit. Fatman, Representative Joe McKenna, Republican Webster, and Mass COP Labor Relations Manager Mike Pereira testified in front of the Joint Committee on Public Service in support of the bill June 3rd. Day in, day out, they don't know what they're walking into, and they don't know whether they'll make it home from their shift, McKenna said of police officers, adding that their sacrifice is shared with their family. Sadly, for Shannon and for Matthew, they did not get to welcome Stephen home from their shift. And it's important for us as a Commonwealth to recognize and to honor the family members left behind. What does the bill say? The bill would direct the Worcester Regional Retirement System to pay Shannon LaPorta an annual pension amount calculated based on Stephen LaPorta holding the rank of sergeant at the time of his death. Fatman said that the town of Uxbridge is 100% in support of the bill, including the Board of Selectmen, the Finance Committee, and the town manager and the whole police department. The legislature has taken similar actions before. Michael Chesna of the Weymouth Police Department was promoted posthumously to sergeant after he was killed in the line of duty in 2018. Fatman asked the committee to expeditiously report the bill out favorably. Blue Star Family's License Plate. The legislature has taken other steps to honor LaPorta and other officers killed in the line of duty this year. Both the Senate and the House passed a bill to create a new Blue Star Family license plate. The plate would be free of charge for Blue Star families or the parent, child, spouse, sibling, or grandchild of a law enforcement officer who was killed in the line of duty. Representative Michael Soter, Republican Bellingham, said on the House floor in May that the bill offers a small yet highly visible token of our enduring gratitude to these survivors. Our next article, Pipe Dream to Legacy, Assabet Valley Master Singers founder to retire. In May 1978, Dr. Robert Eaton brought 28 singers together at Trinity Episcopal Church in Shrewsbury to bring to life a vision he had since his youth. Early on, the ensemble may have worn borrowed robes and put collection baskets at the concert door, but it grew into a regional institution, the Assabet Valley Master Singers. Serving the communities of Shrewsbury, Westboro, Northboro, Southboro, Marlborough, and beyond, AVM, as the chorus is commonly referred to, has brought artistic excellence, community engagement, and visionary programming to all of its performances. Eaton, who continues to serve as artistic director, recently announced he will retire at the end of the 2026 to 2027 concert season. When asked why he is choosing to retire now, Eaton, 79, simply replied, "It's time." It's been 49 years, and the group is in a good place both musically and organizationally, he said. He has mixed feelings about leaving, of course, but the most important thing is to see the group continue and move forward. "I'll still be directing until the end of the 27 season, which will give everyone time to figure things out." Original compositions, the work of masters. Eaton, a native of Vermont, was working as choral director at Algonquin Regional High School in Northborough and as organist and choir director at the First Congregational Church in Marlborough when he came up with the idea to form the Assabet Valley Master Singers. "I thought it would be great to do more with masterworks and major works," he said. "It was something I had always wanted to do. It was just a youngster's pipe dream." The Master Singers have presented works by more than 80 composers, mounted an American premiere and a New England premiere, and commissioned 4 original compositions, 3 by Massachusetts composers. Recent seasons have featured 21st century works engaging urgent human concerns, including Mullacone's Beatitude Mass for the Homeless, Dan Forrest's Requiem for the Living, Eisenwald's The Time Has Come, Gjelo's Songs of the Universal, and Vasque's Dona Nobis Pacem. A commitment to the area has always been something of importance to Eaton and the musical group. In 1979, he established the Assabet Valley Chamber Singers, an 18-voice ensemble dedicated to bringing the larger group's music to nursing homes, library settings, gallery openings, and community events throughout the region. The AVM has collaborated with Algonquin Regional High School and the Worcester Children's Chorus and has started an apprentice singers program welcoming talent high school vocalists into full membership at no cost. Master singers recognize Eaton for his passion and dedication. Eaton is able to bring classical musical compositions to life with his dedication and passion, said Jennifer Garden, a choral member with Assabet Valley Master Singers and the Chamber Singers. There are times when I can remember thinking that a piece was just too challenging for our volunteer chorus to pull off successfully. And yet, with his perseverance and unwavering faith in us, each performance was outstanding, she said. Garden said her father, Jim, had been a tenor with the group for years, and she had attended many concerts. After graduating high school and witnessing an especially moving performance, I went up to Dr. Eaton to congratulate him on a job well done, and he asked if I would be interested in joining the group, she said. I was so honored that he had asked me, and I have been with the group ever since. At one time, both of my brothers, Dan and Dave Garden, sang with the group as well. Judy Yakos, the Master Singers accompanist for 38 years, said, "It's been a deeply rewarding chapter of my life. I usually knew where Dr. Eaton's downbeat was going to land before his baton even moved," she said. "Our collaboration has been the anchor of the choir, and I can honestly say I've had the honor and privilege of working with the very best." Eaton has worked in a variety of roles. Eaton retired as choral director at Algonquin Regional High School in 2005 after 32 years and as minister of music at the First Baptist Church in Lexington after 15 years in 2020. He said he has a year to figure out what he will do with all his free time after retiring from the Master Singers. "It has been the honor of my life to stand before this chorus," he said. "We have built something extraordinary together, a community of musicians committed to the belief that great choral music enriches every life it touches. I am immensely proud of what the Assabet Valley Master Singers has become, and I am confident in the bright future that lies ahead. I wish the world could experience the community of AVM." Our next article. Looking for love in Massachusetts? Survey finds 4 unlikely places. If you're looking for love in Massachusetts, forget smoky bars, sandy beaches, or sweaty gyms, and yes, even, especially, the dating apps. Instead, be sure your antenna is up when you're in the checkout line at Market Basket. ACE.com, an online gaming site, recently reported 4 seemingly unlikely places to meet your match in the Bay State based on a national survey that drew 3,024 respondents. Massachusetts results were a subsection of the overall body of work. "These spots aren't trying to be romantic, which is part of the appeal," Paul Murphy, general manager of ACE.com, wrote in an email in response to a query from Wicked Local. The survey provided multiple choice options as well as an open-ended option. So, without any further ado, here are 4 unlikely yet promising romantic spots in Massachusetts. Cape Cod Ferry Terminals. Noted for their excellent "waiting for summer to begin" energy, ferry terminals are breezy and crowded, allowing for casual chat time and getting to know you moments while waiting in line. Dunkin' Drive-Thru. Exchange a look while waiting for that burst of caffeine, and it could lead to something, perhaps even a complimentary cup of coffee from a driver further up the line. Fewer places capture the Massachusetts romance essence like a Dunkin' drive-thru at 8 a.m. Brimfield Flea Market. Brimfield Flea Market is accidental attraction gold. Miles of antiques, odd furniture, vintage signs, mystery objects, and people confidently considering items they absolutely cannot fit in their cars. What can go wrong? It's an environment in which people can connect over a weird lamp or a box of old postcards and create a unique chemistry. Market basket checkout line. To some extent, grocery stores have long been considered a promising meeting point. But Market Basket has an added distinction, survey respondents claim. The 95-store chain's More for Your Dollar motto allows shoppers to bond over the costs of produce or a good cut of meat. Murphy said everyday places give people an easy reason to talk. No perfect opening line needed when you're both stuck in the same long line or looking at the same weird antique at a flea market, he said. They're everyday Massachusetts settings, which makes a small interaction feel more natural than it would in a formal dating environment. And it's those small interactions that can lead to serendipitous romance. How you behave still matters. Survey results found that the rising costs associated with traditional dating may contribute to the appeal of accidental romance. When asked whether rising prices have made conventional date spots, such as bars, restaurants, concerts, or other paid activities, seem less appealing, 96% of respondents said yes. Nevertheless, good behavior and manners still matter. Being polite to service workers topped the everyday behaviors list that made a good impression on folks, at least according to 96% of survey respondents. Other everyday behaviors that stood out include helping someone with bags, directions, or a photo, returning someone's shopping cart, offering the last seat to someone, being kind to children or dogs, or letting someone cut in line when they're clearly stressed. The biggest accidental romance killer? Being rude to staff at 15%, followed by cutting in line, chronic complaining, being aggressive about parking, littering, and talking loudly on a cell phone. What came through in the survey is that people still like the idea of meeting someone in a more spontaneous way, Murphy said. There's something refreshing about a connection that happens in real life. It feels lower pressure and probably a little more memorable. Our next article, State to Conduct Tests at Uxbridge High. Move comes after several teachers diagnosed with cancer. Uxbridge. The State Department of Public Health will evaluate conditions at Uxbridge High School, where several staff members have been diagnosed with breast cancer over the last few years. The district announced Monday, June 1st, in a letter that was posted to Parent Square, a communication system between the district and families, announcing that members of the State Health Department will conduct testing at Uxbridge High on Thursday, June 4th. It said the district alerted the health department about teachers who had been diagnosed with breast cancer in recent years. Several female teachers have been diagnosed with breast cancer or precancerous conditions over the past few years. The letter, which was signed by Uxbridge Superintendent David Leungberg and Uxbridge High School Principal Michael Rubin, stated. It is, of course, possible that these multiple cases are not connected to one another, but out of abundance of caution, we are looking into any environmental factors at the school that may be a factor in their diagnoses. We held a meeting with the high school staff this afternoon to share what we know so far, as well as the action steps we are taking. Lundberg said as soon as the department became aware of the situation, it contacted the Department of Public Health and the Uxbridge Board of Health. The district worked with epidemiologists, environmental experts, and scientists from both agencies to investigate a variety of environmental factors that could be contributing to the increase in diagnoses. The district said public health officials have also been conducting research about cancer cases, such as subjects' age, medical history, genetic history, specific diagnoses, and other factors, to assess the statistical likelihood of common causes. The district noted that at present, there is no evidence to suggest Uxbridge High School is unsafe, and the district plans on conducting operations at the school as usual. Massachusetts DPH officials have indicated that there is no evidence of immediate danger in the building and no reason to limit access to or use of the facility at this time. The letter states, "In fact, the public health officials have commended our decision to approach them with these concerns, our readiness to partner with them in support of the evaluation process, and our willingness to communicate with full transparency to the entire school community." Leungberg said that on June 4th, the Department of Public Health will conduct tests looking at the facility and its HVAC systems, water quality, air quality, and other conditions on the property. School is expected to be conducted as normal during the tests, which are not expected to interfere with students. The district stated that the Department of Public Health has indicated the likelihood of finding a direct correlation between the diagnoses and the building is slim, and that the final report will be shared with the public. DPH officials have cautioned that in workplace investigations, finding an environmental smoking gun is rare. The letter states, however, even if a direct causal link is not established, the administration is utilizing this process to rigorously test the building and guarantee that it meets all safety standards moving forward. The final public report about the tests conducted by DPH, detailing all parameters and any identified hazards, even benign ones like allergens, will be shared with all families and staff. Uxbridge High School is a relatively new building, constructed in 2012. It serves 596 students in grades 8 through 12. The TNG has reached out to the Uxbridge Teachers Association, the union that represents teachers in Uxbridge Public Schools, for comment, but did not immediately receive a response. Our next article. As Affordable Care Act, ACA, deductibles soar, people seek ways to save. The expiration of the Affordable Care Act's enhanced subsidies left millions of Americans who wanted to keep their insurance in 2026 with a costly choice. Stick with their mid-tier silver plan and pay a pricier monthly bill, or downgrade to cheaper coverage. An analysis released May 19th suggests many switch to plans with cheaper monthly premiums but will pay higher deductibles, the amount a person must pay before most insurance coverage kicks in. Average deductibles for ACA plans reached $3,786 in 2026, up more than $1,000 from a year ago, according to KFF, a health policy nonprofit. Nearly 4 million Americans dropped their mid-tier silver plans, with a total of 9.8 million enrollees, according to KFF. Sign-ups for lower-tier bronze plans reached 9.2 million, a jump of nearly 2 million from a year ago. It's still unknown how many Americans have already or plan to drop ACA coverage, often called Obamacare. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services on January 28th reported about 23 million Americans signed up for ACA coverage in 2026, down from 24.2 million signups as of January 2025. But those figures include many who were automatically re-enrolled. If those consumers fail to pay monthly premiums, the KFF said increased an average of 58% in 2026 without the enhanced subsidies, their coverage will eventually be terminated. CMS won't report those figures until later this year. About 86% of enrollees paid their monthly premiums in January, according to Wakely Consulting Group. The consultant, which analyzed data from insurers in more than 30 states, estimated ACA enrollment this year would drop 17% to 26% from a year ago. KFF projected nearly 5 million could drop their ACA coverage this year. KFF's analysis was based on Wakely's estimates and federal data. The coverage losses look like what people expected, said Cynthia Cox, vice president and director of the program on the ACA at KFF, which is millions of people might drop ACA coverage with the lack of enhanced premium tax credits. In April, a Gallup poll reported that 6 in 10 Americans worry that they will not be able to cover medical costs if they suffer a serious accident or illness. Nearly half are concerned about routine costs. Some are struggling to pay for ACA insurance coverage due to significantly higher monthly bills. In 2026, Wisconsin resident Kelly Berry and her husband had individual bronze insurance plans that had a $7,500 deductible but were fully subsidized. This year, they pay a combined $2,300 per month for plans that carry $8,000 deductibles. Berry said she kept the bronze level plan because I can't find anything cheaper and won't go without coverage. But she said it's a struggle. There's no easy way to find an extra $2,300 by cutting expenses, Berry said. Every time we pay a bill, the mortgage, a credit card, the health insurance premium, we have to watch our bank accounts to make sure we have money in the right places to cover things. You have been listening to a reading of the Milford Daily News. This community news program is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Sara Susskind. Thank you for listening.
There are more than 1 million English words. Next up, word nerd Steph Donoff with some of them worth talking about.
The Latin alphabet was first developed more than 2,000 years ago in Italy and had only 23 letters to start with, not 26, 23. The J, the U, and the W started to show up once printing was developed in the 1600s. They were not formally added to the alphabet, they were absorbed slowly over time. In 1611, the first edition of the King James Bible spelled James with an I, pronounced as a J, as was Joseph, John, and even Jesus. But some unknown scribe had created the letter J, and it was used in the 1629 edition, and since it was good enough for the Bible, everyone started using it. Now, before printing, the letter V also did double duty. As a consonant, it was written as a pointy bottom V, pronounced V. When used as a vowel, the V was given a round bottom and pronounced as U, but it was still treated as a V. As printing developed, it was printed as two separate letters and the letter U was born. Now, the W started as two V's stuck together, even though it meant the sound of two U's stuck together. By the way, there are a few English words with double U's, but only three of them are in common use: vacuum, continuum, and to dress it up a bit, Hawaiian muumuus.
That's enough talk about words. Let's go back to listening to them.